This morning is Paterno versus U.S. Mr. O'Reilly.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Robert O'Reilly, and I represent Thomas Paterno, who's a petitioner in a habeas corpus petition. I'd like to make my remarks brief. I actually think it's a kind of a straightforward case. I mean, obviously, the briefing isn't nearly as extensive as some of the others you've had this morning. I think Judge Randa made a mistake in how he read the record, and it resulted in serious prejudice to Mr. Paterno. Judge Randa found that the original petition was abandoned. And he did so on the basis of the fact that we didn't file a reply brief. Instead, we filed a motion to amend under Rule 15 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Perhaps if the reply brief were mandatory, if it had been required, then perhaps the judge could say, well, you didn't follow through with it and stuff. But that's not the case
record. Wasn't it ordered? Wasn't a reply ordered?
No, a reply brief was invited. His order, which is Record 26, specifically says that the petitioner is invited to reply a reply brief. And in fact, if you take a look at the docket entry, it says the petitioner may file a brief by January 15th. So there's a deadline. If I'm going to file one, I have to file it by, it was January 15th, 2010. But there's certainly nothing that requires that. And that also comports with our local rules. Rule 7 says that a brief may be filed within 14 days.
The trouble I've got with your case, I think the motion to amend is very clever, but the problem is that there's nothing, there's no amendment to it. The 2255 that was filed with that or attached to that in no way resembles the first one. And then underlying my trouble about that is the first one's a phony. It's fictitious.
Well, let me address both those points. First off, with regard to it being phony, that's not something that my client has ever conceded. He's gone to trial on the issue. So, I mean, that is certainly nothing that we voluntarily conceded, said yes, that was for fraud.
So what out of it did he place into the amended one?
Let me explain exactly what happened. Our first argument was that one of the convictions did not count for ACAA purposes, for armed career criminal purposes.
Because he'd been issued a
certificate.
Right.
A discharge certificate, right. And there's a body of law there that says that
if you... that would have followed over into the amended 2255.
Well, no, but again, why would you argue that case when that entire offense as a matter of law under the changed law that is recognized by Chambers and then subsequently ruled on by this court says that offense, as well as the other two, don't count for ACCA purposes?
Certainly an additional reason, and when you plead, so often you plead multiple theories, and if it was a viable theory at one time, if you're amending it, you carry something of it.
Well, Your Honor, I think what you have to recognize is that I have limited time. I have a limited space to argue. I'm going to put my best arguments forward. If I have to say, if I'm going to marry what is a dead bang winner with a messy case involving allegations of fraud, in which there's a ton of evidence, there's an issue of attorney-client privilege, in which they're bringing in evidence with that, none of that becomes material. I've got a simple, dead-bang, on-the-face merits. This man should not be in jail for the next 240 months because none of his offenses qualify under the Armed Career Criminal Act. Why would I marry that nonsense getting this, whether Scott Bolano is telling the truth, the hiring a forensic expert.
Then you are not amending at all. You are abandoning all of those things in the initial.
There was a change in the law which superseded the theory. Now, under Johnson versus United States, this court specifically held that litigants have the right to amend their complaint to add or drop claims. And that's all we did. We simply said this violation, as well as two others, don't count under the ACCA. It was the same violation, it was the same argument in both.
So were you dropping the other claim, the initial?
No, we're changing our theory of why it doesn't count under the ACCA. What we did was we said, look, you could argue the certificate. If I had known that I had to keep it in the case, I would have. No question about it. I would have. And I was never asked, are you withdrawing it?
You feel you could have done that under Rule 11?
Absolutely. My client tells me that that's the real certificate. Why not? I mean, he went to trial on the matter.
At that point, you're in the face of the government's response, the indictment. I don't know that the jury verdict had come in yet.
No, there was no jury. There was no jury. That came much later. My client's gone to trial. That case is not final. I mean, that is still an open question. I think that it's very unfair that this court would then say that you not only are you not on notice that you had to file the reply brief and keep this intact, when in fact it wasn't specified that a reply brief was mandatory. So that's the first thing. Secondly, that if you don't keep one of your original claims, that the whole case is going to be thrown out. It seems to me that that's a denial of due process. There was no notice. There was no warning on that. And the judge then refused to even pass on the motion to amend.
So you would agree that Judge Randa really never addressed the motion to amend. He didn't consider
it. No, he in fact ruled that he didn't have jurisdiction to consider it because he said it's a second or successive habeas petition. But the only way that you can support that ruling is if you say that the first one was in fact voluntarily withdrawn. And how you get there is you say, well, it was you didn't file a reply brief, and therefore it was abandoned, and therefore it was voluntarily withdrawn. From my perspective, I've never seen that before in a case. If my client's being sanctioned, he certainly wasn't given the opportunity to respond with notice in a hearing. So, I mean, it seems to me one of these things where he was given just by judicial fiat, absolutely, you get no relief. You don't get a decision on the merits with respect to the certificate. You don't get a decision on the merits with respect to the motion to amend. You're simply out of court. And again, the reply brief, not required under law. And I really think that the point that I want to emphasize is that it was a dramatic change in the law. Under Chambers, as this court held, he had his offenses would count under the ACCA. After the Supreme Court reversed this court in Chambers, it was clear that they would not. I reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, my name is Gordon Jim Pietro. I'm an assistant United States attorney in Milwaukee, and I represent the United States. Ordinarily, in a case like this with the multitude of issues that are before the court, I would start with the procedural ones and work to the substantive ones. There are a number of substantive arguments in the reply brief that I need to address initially because I think they're important to maybe focus this case to a more workable conclusion, and it's the following. Mr. Vetrano in his reply brief says that really the discussion about whether the escape conviction falls under Chambers is academic or it's immaterial because he points to his two endangering safety convictions and says those don't count either. Those are the ones you should focus on. You should look at the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision in Jensen. You should look at this court's decisions in High and Bishop and McDonald and say that those two don't count, and therefore the discussion of the escape conviction is really immaterial. That's exactly wrong, and I'll explain why. And I think it's also exactly wrong, and it carries forward from this court's certificate of appealability order, which I will respectfully say I think is also wrong. And let me explain why. The certificate of appealability order says, in light of Chambers, Mr. Vetrano made a substantial showing that in light of Chambers, all three of the predicates don't count. The difficulty with that is that may be true on a direct appeal. It's not true in habeas under 2255F. It has to be a decision of the United States Supreme Court. And so while the escape conviction is in play after Chambers, if this amendment were allowed, the convictions for endangering safety are not. 2255F says the decision has to be of the Supreme Court of the United States. So respectfully, certificate of appealability and Mr. Vetrano's reply brief are exactly wrong. If amendment were allowed, the only conviction that is in play is the escape conviction. It is not the endangering safety convictions. Those rest on decisions of this court and are not could not be brought in 2255F. So substantively, I think it's important when Mr. Riley says he's got dead bang winners, and that's why he didn't really say he abandoned, but of course I don't know what else you can say when he doesn't file a notice of appeal with respect to Judge Randa's dismissal of that initial petition, that initial claim. He has no beef with the fact that that initial petition or the claim and that initial, those claims in the initial petitions are no longer viable. If he had some desire to maintain those and hold on to them, they would have factored in his notice of appeal. They would have been briefed in this court. This was abandonment. The second issue I'd like to talk about that is procedural and substantive, I think, is this question of when the one-year trigger starts under 2255F3. We've argued in our brief it's under Begay as opposed to Chambers, and I will explain why.
Now, Judge Randa hasn't addressed that. Would you agree?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. And one of the arguments in the reply brief that I should address is this question of waiver. May I address that briefly?
Well, and one of the factors under Rule 15A is timeliness of a motion for leave to amend. And Judge Randa hasn't addressed that either.
No, that's correct, Your Honor.
And that timeliness could relate to this time frame.
Yes, it could, Your Honor. Yes. And with respect to the waiver argument made in the reply brief, I would simply point out this. We did not waive any of these arguments. In our opposition to the motion to amend, it's in the record at document 30, I think it's page 9, footnote 3, we said, look, if we're ordered to respond to these amended claims under Rule 4, there are a whole host of issues we need to address. And this court also, in its certificate of appealability order, invited the parties to address these substantive and procedural issues. And so I don't believe there's a credible argument that we've waived these arguments. Why Begay and not Chambers? And I think here's why. Begay is really the new rule that says predicates under 924 have to be purposeful, like the enumerated offenses. Chambers is merely a further extension of that rule in the context of an Illinois failure to return conviction. So you could see in a different circumstance, Mr. Vetrano's conviction is a Wisconsin escape conviction. It is not an Illinois failure to return offense. So why does Chambers necessarily trigger the clock under 2255F? So we would submit that it was Begay that's really the new rule here. That's the better clock, the better starting point for the clock under 2255F. Otherwise, this issue or these issues regarding what is a predicate or not under Begay, what is purposeful or not, it's going to extend on into the future until the Supreme Court or this court touches on every different conviction of every different state in the country. And so the better rule here is the timeliness under Begay. That's when the clock starts. Mr. Vetrano responds to that argument by saying, well, this is terribly unfair. How can you do this to uncounseled prisoners? Well, the reality is Begay came down in April of 08. Mr. O'Reilly was appointed in June of 08. This court in September of 08 in Templeton said, hey, look, we have to rethink the Wisconsin escape statute in light of Begay. So well within that one-year period of Begay, Mr. Vetrano, with counsel, has the benefit of this court's decision in Templeton that says, hey, maybe an escape is not going to be purposeful under Begay. This may be a basis to challenge. And so it is not unfair in the context of this case, certainly, and as a general principle, to say that if you're going to challenge the purposefulness of the predicate offense, the clock started with Begay, as opposed to any number of subsequent decisions of the Supreme Court or this court. Finally, in terms of what we would like the government, what outcome we think is appropriate here, first and foremost, we don't think Judge Randa erred. Whether it's de novo review or abuse of discretion review, this, as Your Honor pointed out, this really was abandonment. There was no effort to preserve this in any way in the new petition. That petition is at document 27 in the record. It's not repeated. This is an abandonment. That's the first holding we would like from this court, that Judge Randa was correct in his ruling. Secondarily, we'd like this ruling that the clock starts with Begay, not subsequent decisions. Begay starts the clock under 2255F3. Barring that, worst case outcome from the government in our view would be, if you find Judge Randa committed an error of law or abused his discretion, you reject our argument about the clock starting with Begay, and you remand to allow the amendment, the only thing that can be amended here is a challenge to the escape conviction. That is the only one that falls under a Supreme Court decision in Chambers. The endangering safety convictions, although interesting and maybe viable on direct appeal, are not viable in 2255. It has to be a decision in the Supreme Court. If there are no further questions.
There is, I do have a question. I am troubled about the amendment issue here and language that we've got in prior cases like Johnson versus U.S. from 1999 that the amendment would need to be considered as long as the original 2255 was pending.
Right.
How do we deal with those cases and get where you want to go?
Right. I think you have to, and again, I did not address this in my brief in this court. I did address it in front of Judge Randa. You have to, and follow this through for me. Johnson was decided in 1999. There's a case from this court called Elsie. I think it was in 2003. It's 324 F3rd 521. In that case, this court said, choosing between a circuit split, we're going to give a very broad reading to the relation back doctrine under 15C. And we have to go this way because if we don't go this way and choose this side of the circuit split, we have to overrule Johnson. That basically the outcome in Johnson dictated the outcome of this court's decision in Elsie. Well, Elsie was subsequently abrogated by the Supreme Court in Maley versus Felix in 2005. And so the broad reading of Rule 15 that this court announced in Johnson, I don't think is viable after the Supreme Court's decision in Maley versus Felix. So there is a real question about how do you balance the liberal amendment provisions of Rule 15 with the very strict pleading requirements of 2255. And this court, I think, has twice been on the wrong side of where the Supreme Court ultimately came down. Maley versus Felix is one example. The other one is Dodd versus United States, which set forth this principle that the clock starts when the right or the rule is announced, not when it's made retroactive.
Those are concerns that could be addressed in evaluating the motion for leave to amend, correct?
The Supreme Court said no.
Reflect on timeliness or the potential merit of the underlying amendment.
I would say yes, Your Honor. That's correct. In sort of in the way that I've argued this, that if amendment were allowed here, Judge Randick, or that he should have entertained the motion to amend, he could say I'm going to allow the amendment as to Chambers, but not as to the endangering safety.
Or he could deny the amendment.
As untimely even. The problem that Maley, I think, deals with is that this court had said, you know, those protections in Rule 15 that talk about delay and prejudice and so forth don't carry over into the 2255 context. It's a different animal. It's not like a typical civil proceeding. So I guess that's a long way of answering. I think Johnson on its face is problematic for my argument, but if you follow it through Elsie and then Maley versus Felix, I think Johnson has been undermined tremendously. So thank you for your time, and we ask that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Riley. How much time? 3 minutes, Mr. Riley.
Great. First off, I'd like to object that defendant in this case is citing cases that weren't discussed in the brief, both Elsley and I think Dodd versus United States. Neither one of them appear in the table of cases, and I don't recall them being cited for this case. Putting that aside, I certainly have a major problem with the idea that Begay is when the clock should start and not Chambers. I think first and foremost, at the time that Begay was decided, you had binding circuit court precedent that was against that. Begay involved drunk driving, which is very different from reckless endangerment, very different from an offense like escape. I have real problems that you would start the clock there. Certainly, the United States Department of Justice wasn't sanctioned for filing a frivolous defense in Chambers. They certainly thought that their petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court would have merit. They certainly didn't concede error. But yet, despite that, my client is supposed to determine that, in fact, Begay has totally changed the law. And certainly, I wasn't aware of this body of law until really Chambers started to come around. The case that I was given was one on the discharge certificates, and that's where my focus was for a good portion of the case. And it was only until I started to happen upon Chambers that I started to become aware of this particular issue. So that's number one. Number two, Maley and Felix. Maley and Felix involved a relation back doctrine under Rule 15C. Whatever the government sees in that case, I don't see it. The only way that 15C applies is if Rule 15 applies, and that's what we're seeking. And if you measure the time from Chambers, which I think you have to, our complaint, our amended petition is timely. It was brought within 1 year, and therefore there's no need to even go to a relation back argument because it's timely on its face. So I think that's the second thing. With respect to the timeliness and the waiver issue, there's no question that the government might be able to revisit it, but they can't revisit it in the context of the motion to amend because they did waive that. They chose not to argue that. They can argue it on the merits, but they can't argue it in the context of the motion. They simply missed their opportunity to do that. If there are no questions, I'll sit down, but maybe there's something you want to specifically ask.
I just want to thank you for taking the case on appointment. And,
thank you.
Thanks to the court and vigorously representing your client.
Thank you very much.
Case will be taken under advisement.